I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 6 years ago, while thousands of scientists and lobbyists and politicians gathered in Kyoto, Japan to debate the question of global warming, I had a chance to visit one of the old Buddhist temple gardens in that city. And it is a city where gardening is a revered art, a tradition handed down within the family. The man I met represented the 17th generation of gardeners in his family. He had records going back almost 700 years. Not much had changed, actually, except for the last 50 years or so. The cherry trees aren't as strong as they once were, he observed. The cold winter weather that once helped harden that annual ring of growth, he told me, doesn't happen anymore. So there are more bugs. There is more disease in the trees. The birds, he says, leave later. Now, at the time when this gardener was leading me through his carefully kept books, the scientists were barely managing to make the case that global warming was real and not some tree-hugger's plot designed to bring down ExxonMobil. Here we are, 6 years later, and the Kyoto Accord is still far from having its intended effect. What is your view of climate change today? Do you see it where you live? How do you see the changing climate changing the landscape and the character of your home? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we will be talking with a number of writers this hour who make it their business to study the effects of global warming. First, though, to Milan, Italy, where the BBC reporter Tim Hirsch is standing by. He's covering the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. Tim, good to be talking with you.
Good to speak to you.
I gather that what's happening so far, with the one exception of Russia, yes, we're in, no, we're not, has been relatively low-key. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. And I think the first thing to say is that this is not the conference that it was supposed to be. This is one of the regular follow-up conferences from Kyoto under what's known as the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And it had been hoped that by the time this conference in Milan took place, the Kyoto Protocol, which is the agreement, as you say, signed 6 years ago in Japan, would have entered into legal force. And there would have been a great deal to talk about following on from that. But because Russia has still not, as you say, ratified the protocol, it means that under the very complex UN rules surrounding this process, it hasn't entered into force, and everyone is at the moment pretty well waiting to see which way Russia will go. So what this meeting has turned out to be is actually a pretty technical process. It doesn't stop many hundreds of people turning up here. But what is happening is that over these 2 weeks, some very detailed rules surrounding the Kyoto Protocol are being finalized, but of course all of that is contingent on the protocol actually taking force, which it hasn't yet.
Tim, I understand that later in the week the national leaders from across Europe or ministers or secretaries are due to come to Italy. If the confusion over the protocol's very future continues the way it has, do you think a lot of those people will just not bother coming at all, but stay at home rather than be part of what, you know, might appear to be a failed exercise?
Well, they will turn up because there are, if you like, housekeeping matters to sort out amongst the ministers. It's, as I say, it was always going to be a pretty modest meeting, given the fact that Russia had not ratified by this point. I think, though, when the politicians do turn up, you're going to hear a considerable amount of rhetoric on the Russian position. I think we can absolutely confidently say that between now and Wednesday, when that ministerial segment starts, we're not going to be any clearer as to where Russia is going. Last week, there was what appeared to be two or three 180-degree turns on the part of various parts of the Russian administration as to whether it was going to ratify. In fact, what we were seeing and what we continue to see is something of an internal power struggle between some of those very close to President Putin advising on economic matters, mm-hmm. and some people in the key ministries, indeed the very important one, the Economics and Trade Ministry, who are much more favorably disposed towards Kyoto. Now, of course, what we've had in the interim is the elections to the Russian Duma, the lower house of parliament, as you just reported. And there are some here who take a little bit of comfort there, because it was, ironically, the communists who were some of the most vociferous opponents of Russia ratifying Kyoto. And now it's quite clear that President Putin doesn't need to worry so much about them and can make up his own mind in the long term as to whether it's in Russia's interest to ratify.
Quick last point, Tim. Russia wouldn't be at the very center of this conversation if the United States hadn't chosen to bow out of the protocol 2 years ago. Is anybody talking about the role of the U.S. here?
Well, they are. There's talk about, you know, has the Bush administration put pressure on President Putin not to go ahead and ratify? But certainly many people, no one is expecting any change in the Bush administration's line on this. But some people are looking at other initiatives within the U.S., for instance, what's happening at the state level, and reminding people that what the White House decides isn't the sum total of action being taken across America.
Tim, thanks so much for being with us. Tim Hirsch is at the United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Milan, Italy. Now, Granta Magazine's latest issue is called This Overheating World. And we're going to be talking through the balance of this hour to some of its contributors. Bill McKibben is joining us from Middlebury College, where he is scholar in residence. He's also author of a number of books, including most recently Enough, Genetic Engineering and the End of Human Nature. His essay in Granta is called Worried Us, question marks after both words. Mark Linus is joining us from the BBC in London. He's a journalist, writer, and climate change campaigner. He's the author of the forthcoming High Tide, News from a Warming World. His essay in Granta is called Hot News. I want to thank both of you for being with us on the program today.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Bill, let me start with you. You begin the magazine by saying that we are fatally confused about time and place when it comes to global warming, climate change. What do you mean by that?
Well, here's the thing. Even people who understand and sort of say that, oh, it's just a problem, one we have to get to, don't understand the scale of the issue that we're facing. The science of it is not very hard to understand if you sit down and think about it for a few minutes, but we tend not to do that. You know, 1989, which is when my involvement with all this really began, I wrote a book called The End of Nature that was sort of the first book on this subject. At that point, it was a hypothesis, this idea that humans were burning enough coal and oil and gas to materially alter the world's climate. It seemed almost counterintuitive that one species could be affecting everything that happened on the surface. In the next 5 years, science went very hard to work. And by 1995, the world's climatologists, before Kyoto, issued this initial statement saying, yes, human beings were heating up the planet. Since then, it's been as if the Earth itself has been sort of peer-reviewing that science. We've had one warm year after another, 9 of the 10 warmest years on record in the last decade. And now we understand that even with a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in global average temperature, which is what we've seen so far, the world is reacting in enormous ways. Every place that's frozen on the planet Earth is busy melting, and melting fast. Every glacial system is in retreat. Sea level is rising. All those, you can list 100 effects already. And now the scientists, the same group of climatologists, tell us that before this century is out, unless we make remarkable changes, much more deep even than those envisioned in Kyoto, we'll see a further increase in temperature of something on the order of 5 degrees Fahrenheit, making the world warmer than it's been for several hundred million years. That's the scale of the problem we're talking about. It's probably the first civilizational scale problem that humans have yet had to come to grips with. And so far, not politically and certainly not emotionally, have we managed to absorb this news and figure out what it really means.
There is one image from the Granta magazine that, Mark Linus, you can help us with. This is a photograph of a glacier which your father took some years ago in the Peruvian Andes and actually became a starting point for a story that you worked on.
Yeah, that's right. I was actually watching a slideshow with my family, which is something that we do every Christmas, and we used to all live in Peru 20 years ago, when my father was working as a geologist in the highest part of the Andes, and he brought up this picture of how the glacier looked when he was working there in 1980, and it just occurred to me in a flash, well, I'm interested in climate change impacts, in what's happening with regard to global warming, not in the future but now, so why not go back to this place in Peru, which is very remote, very inaccessible, so no one else would really have been there in the meantime and taken any pictures. So I wanted to head back there and actually see what had happened. And
so you made a print, a black and white or a color print of this image?
Sure, we made a color print. We just printed out on the printer that he's got attached to his computer when we scanned in the slide. It was that simple, and I took these prints and a couple of other ones and a map, the old map that he had, to because we didn't know exactly where this place was. And I got a local bus and then hired two donkeys and went with our gear up, hiking up this valley. And after quite a long trek and at very high altitude, it was about not far off 5,000 meters, actually. I'm not sure what that is in feet. We got back to where this glacier was, and the change was staggering.
What did you see? Describe the difference.
Well, in the original picture, which as I say was taken in 1980, there's this big bluish sort of fan-shaped glacier which is tumbling down from this huge icefall and right down into a lake. And the lake's full of icebergs because the glacier was so big that there was bits of it breaking off all the time and just floating around in the lake. And so it was really quite an amazing scene. It was very dominated by this huge, huge glacier which was there at the time. And when we went back, I just thought I wasn't even sure it was the same place because the glacier had completely gone. All there was now was this rock wall, and the lake was still there, and I think that's more or less what confirmed it. And we could actually line up by holding an old picture up. We could line up exactly with the camera to retake the picture, just judging by the contours and the rock, and it was definitely the same place, and the glacier had disappeared in its entirety, which was something that I was not prepared for, and my father was not prepared for emotionally when I told him about it. He was really devastated to hear the news. He was saying really that this is the whole character of the place. He couldn't really believe that the place that he'd really grown to love so many years ago had no longer exists in today's world.
Bill McKibben, is that what it takes? Does somebody need to see something that means something to them for them to kind of go, oh, this matters. I need to either be involved or pay attention.
I think that that's enormously important, and I think it's one of the reasons why people in rural areas of this country, for instance, who pay probably a little more attention to the passage of the seasons and things, are more likely to have picked up on what's going on. But there's also, of course, even for people in the cities and suburbs for whom it's not yet as immediate a problem, it's not that huge a leap of the kind of moral imagination to begin to understand what's going on. When you read about people in South Pacific Islands who have cultures that stretch back extant for 4,000 years, who are now have voted and have begun the process of evacuating their islands en masse to go to New Zealand or Australia because the sea level is high enough that it's now storm surges washing over their homes with some regularity, that should be enough to begin to give you some idea. When you read in the newspaper that last summer, in the course of about 6 days across Europe, when the temperature got higher than it had ever gotten before, and when the nighttime minimums didn't fall, just what the computer models suggest, 30,000 Europeans, 15,000 French people, basically baked to death in their apartments. These sort of things should be enough, finally, to begin to get us off the dime.
All right, Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. When the water goes up on those South Pacific islands or when the permafrost melts in a place like Alaska, are you making a connection to the changes that are happening in your own home when you look at the climate change that's going on? 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. The latest edition of Granta magazine is called This Overheating World. It is a collection of essays and observations by writers and people who have been traveling all around the world, as well as people staying a little bit closer to home, talking about what they see as evidence of climate change. And we're interested in hearing from you about what you see, whether or not this debate that began 15-some-odd years ago, as Bill McKibben said earlier, is past us, or whether or not there's still an argument to be made about the real impact of global warming. 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring Philip Marsden in right now. His essay in the Granta magazine is called The Weather in Mongolia. And Philip, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
The climate that you're describing in Mongolia is one that's very extreme. In your travels, in your experience, is it the places where the weather is already in extreme where you notice the kinds of changes we're talking about?
Well, I think the interesting thing about Mongolia is that, yes, it has this incredibly extreme climate. It's known as extreme continental, the technical tag for it. And because of that, there's really only one way that people can practice any sort of way of life, which is pastoralism. And people move from place to place with their tents and their herds. In winters, which the temperature drops to sort of minus 40, and then in the summer it's sort of it's more temperate. But it's a way of life that hasn't really changed, and so you can see very clearly the way that climate change operates on them. It's an immensely tough way of life. I mean, I couldn't imagine spending a winter there with temperatures so low, and yet it's very delicate as well. So the slightest change means, you know, a big calamity, which is what's been happening over the last sort of 10 or 15 years, noticeably.
And in your essay, you also write about overgrazing taking place in Mongolia and water pollution that's happening there and a large jump in population. Do these just stir into the mix to make climate change more dramatic?
Yes, the overgrazing is in part because the grass. What happens is that normally there's not a high snowfall, so that the herds can eke out a sort of living during the winter. But when there is snow, of course, there's no grass at all. And when the snow melts, what grass there is has disappeared. So the herds have to go further and further to find grazing. So they buffer up against each other's holdings, if you like. So the whole place, which if you look at it, is this vast expanse of grassland in the summer, actually is. It's very delicately balanced for all the herders and all the herds that live there.
And Philip, one of the fascinating things about Mongolia is that for so many of the years of the last century, it was under the thumb of the Soviet Union and under the control of people who lived so many miles away. And now when the land is changed and affected by features which appear to be out of the hands of the people who live there, how do they make sense of that? How, in terms of either their understanding of you know, God or the weather or fate or divinity, do they find some kind of explanation for what's going on?
Well, that was the thing that interested me when I went out, because in my research I discovered that this very traditional way of life and really the only way of life that they can lead, of course, is tied up with belief systems, and which in turn is tied up with the particular landscape that they inhabit. For instance, the word for God and weather and sky, Tinga, is all the same. So you can see how the sort of sky and the weather and the divinities begin to sort of interact. And of course, when the weather goes strange, it's the whole world that's going strange. It's a sort of divine, a sense of divine imbalance that's beginning to occur. And you mentioned, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union in the last sort of 15 years, and of course Mongolia was a sort of satellite state, if you like, of Moscow, and that's brought into play all sorts of other social instabilities, which have coupled with the sort of climate change to create an enormous sense of insecurity. And you know, in spending time with the herders and sort of living with them, it was very disturbing in a way to see how people sense their world sort of becoming so insecure, and it was a world, you know, that they'd inhabited for sort of thousands of years, completely unchanged, and now in the last 10, 20 years, it has changed, you know, it was beginning to change beyond sort of recognition, and I think that left a sense of deep unease. I mean, everyone who knows agricultural communities know that that dependence on natural forces outside your control. But in a pastoralist society, and one so traditional, it's of a greater magnitude than, you know, we can imagine, really.
Philip, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
Philip Marsden's essay in the Granta magazine is called The Weather in Mongolia. Philip is a travel writer, a novelist, author of the book most recently, The Main Cages. And Mark Linus, you've been traveling all over the place, touching down in Alaska and Australia and China and the South Pacific. When you listen to Philip's description of this world being turned upside down by factors beyond the control of the people there, is that something that you found linked the different places where climate change was actually having an effect?
Yes, that's exactly what I found. Interestingly, I was not far away from Mongolia in northern China in Gansu province. And
right.
One of the main problems I've got there is the same kind of desertification issue. And you've got these enormous dust storms which just blow in from the Gobi Desert. And actually, there have been occasions where tens of people are killed by these dust storms. In 1993, I think 85 people were killed, mostly children. And this is something which...
What, they get
just
lost
didn't...
and disoriented? Or...
Yeah, they either get buried by sand and suffocated, or they can't see... They can't even see their hands in front of their faces. It's called a black wind. I mean, I experienced one of these myself, and it was almost as if it was nighttime. When it finally cleared away about 4 hours later, the cockerels were crowing in this village because they thought it was morning. It was the most amazing experience. And this is, again, something which was pretty much outside the experience of people who are living there and is happening a lot more frequently. And also, I went, as you mentioned, I went to the South Pacific. I went to the islands of the Tuvaluan Islands, which is about 10,000 people scattered over 9 very small atolls. And their average height above sea level is only about 50 centimeters. So they're very vulnerable to any increasing sea levels, which is what's already happening. And when I was standing there at one time, the sea levels were rising enough that I was actually splashing through water in the middle of the town.
This is water coming right up through the roads,
sure,
through the lawns and in the town.
Absolutely, yeah. The water, because the islands are made of this porous fossil coral rock, there's no way you can actually keep the water out because it just rises up through the middle. And so it's like little springs that just appear all over the place through these little holes. And suddenly you find that you're up to knee deep in water and there's fish swimming around in people's gardens and stuff like that. It was a very strange thing to see. And because this is happening a lot more frequently now than it used to be a very occasional event, and now it's happening for at least half the year. People know that they're going to have to leave their islands because they can no longer support themselves through crops, because you've got saltwater intrusion now on the fresh water table. And also you've got entire little islands which have begun to disappear. Their vegetation has been washed off them because of the sea level rise.
Right.
And so people are planning to move en masse to New Zealand. And the program at the moment is that 75 people will leave every year.
All right. Climate change. Connection listeners. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. What are you seeing? Let's go to Watertown, New York. Roger, you're up. What are you seeing where you are?
Well, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I've lived in this area for about 10 years, and from what the folks tell me that have lived there all their lives, say that the winters are milder. But from my point of view, they're quite cold. Sometimes we'll have 20 below zero for a week at a time, and I've personally experienced 38 below zero here. It's interesting that there seem to be more unusual weather patterns here, though. Over the past 10 years, we've had a severe ice storm, then a microburst, then another very severe ice storm, the one in 1998, all over the Northeast, and then a drought.
And you've just been through a fairly hefty blizzard, too, haven't you?
Well, you know, what's interesting is usually here in Watertown area, we get quite a bit of snow. It passed us. We feel guilty.
Don't worry. I think there are people who have enough snow to go around. But Bill McKibben, just the question about the extremes in weather pattern that Roger's talking about, what's the connection there that we should know about?
There are two things. I mean, when you get these big and continuing changes in global averages, one of the things that does is mask all kinds of huge swings and extremes. So you get far more days of extreme heat. Heat waves are longer and stronger. And also, over time, you begin to see real trends emerge. For instance, Roger lives not far from Lake Champlain. There are terrific records on for the last 250 years on ice freeze on Lake Champlain. Every once in a while over that record, there'd be a year when the lake didn't freeze totally, stem to stern, in the course of a winter. But until last winter, there had been 6 years in a row in the late part of the 1990s when it didn't freeze, by far the longest record like that. In fact, all over New England, people have done these interesting studies. You may know that in some of the small, a lot of the small towns, the Rotary Club or the Lions Club or whatever, for years and years have conducted raffles where they used to, now they'll put a, you know, some kind of buoy or something out on the ice. They used to park a car out in the ice, and then they'd sell chances on what day it was going to disappear through the ice in the spring, when it was going to melt. The records of all those when they've been gathered together show that spring is coming about 2 weeks earlier, a week and a half earlier at Rogers' latitude. There was a paper in Nature a few weeks ago showing that across the Northern Hemisphere as a whole, if you look at every phenomenon, leaf out, bird nesting, so on, all the sort of things that you can track on a seasonal basis, spring is about 5 days earlier than it was 30 years ago.
And Mark Linus, you saw the same thing in Fairbanks, Alaska, did you not?
That's right. They also have a lottery there about when the ice is going to break up and the rivers are going to start moving again.
A big lottery, too.
Yeah, a big lottery. It's worth $500,000. I mean, so people watch very carefully. There's no debate about when how accurate these records are. And they go back to about 1920. And again, there's about 8 days less. 8 days less winter happening in Alaska now, and that in fact masks some of the very extreme changes people are talking about, where they used to get minus 40 or minus 50 below in the really darkest, worst period of the winter, and now it barely goes to 20 below. And they can see how the ducks aren't migrating south like they used to. Mm-hmm. These bears don't know whether to hibernate, and a lot of the native Alaskans are really noticing these changes because they live much closer to the land, obviously, than people do in the cities, and they find that it's not safe to go out on the sea ice anymore because it doesn't freeze as thickly, and that the walruses and the seals and other marine mammals that live in the very far north are very, very affected by this, and their migration patterns are changing, and they just aren't there to be found anymore. So this is a major effect on native people's lifestyles, as well as more broadly across the whole state.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Roger, thanks for that. Next to Boston, and Helene's joining us. Hi there.
Hi there. My mother has a little cottage on Buzzards Bay in Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. She bought it from my great-grandfather in 1925, and I spent most of my summers there as a child about 50 years ago. And I particularly remember playing in the dunes, which were magnificent and mysterious and separated you from the adult world. And now most of those dunes are gone. We have marshland behind the dunes, which is a bird sanctuary, and the bay side is in front. And we used to walk down the beach up and down every summer. Well, last summer, I sort of had a shock because as I walked along the beach, I was elevated by some of the dunes that had been washed away so that the level had risen a little of the sand, and I was able to actually look at both at the same time. To the left, I could see the marsh, and to the right, I could see the bay, whereas in the past, these dunes formed a barrier, so you couldn't see both at the same time.
And so a lot of the land is disappearing.
Well, it's changing. The shoreline is changing from the rising sea level, and I feel that in another few years, the shore from the bay will break into the marsh and begin to encroach into the marsh, mm-hmm. and will change the entire shoreline there. And in the process of that, our house is definitely going to be obliterated.
Helene, when people alongside Buzzards Bay talk about this, as they do at summer places, I know, is there any question that this is a cycle and things will go back? Are there people saying, no, it's definitely climate change? Are there people saying no? How are people there talking about it?
I don't believe it can go back once you've obliterated this marshland and the bird sanctuary and the bay water comes in. The whole ecosystem is going to change dramatically. The shoreline will change. If it does go back, it would probably take, you know, hundreds or maybe thousands of years to rebuild an entirely different beach line. But this has happened so quickly. I started noticing it maybe 20 years ago, and you can see lines on the people's seawalls. Some of the people have seawalls, we don't, where it just comes up higher. And what's happening is we had a point. The point went down the bay on one side, back into the inlet and the marsh. And now there was a building at the end of the point at one time, and the cement pillars from that building are about, I paced it out last year, they're 350 feet away from the end of the dunes when they were on the dunes originally. So we've lost 350 feet from the end of the dunes, which means that it's just moving upward. The whole line is moving upward, and as we're one of the last houses there, we're just going to be drowned out.
Eleni, I want to hear from Bill McKibben on this, because I know that in these sorts of debates, Bill, people are saying, well, you can't look at what happens over 20 years. You can't look at what happens over 50 years.
Actually, by now, the science is incredibly clear on all of this. One of the reasons that the sea level is going up at the moment, the reason that it's going up fastest, is simply because warm water takes up more space than cold water does. There's a thermal expansion equation. And the best guess estimate is that sea level is going to go up another 2 or 3 feet in the course of this century. Because of that, that's going to be enough to make, you know, life on the Cape very different. But the places where it's really going to kick in are places like Bangladesh. 140 million people living in an area the size of Wisconsin that's only a couple of meters above sea level in the great river delta of Asia. By a lot of estimates, the number of environmental refugees this century will exceed the number of political refugees in the last one. And the Cape is a very interesting place to look at because, as your listeners in New England know, they've been embroiled in the big environmental debate there in the last year has been whether or not to put wind power out into Nantucket Sound. Mm-hmm. That's just the kind of thing we need to do if we're going to have any hope of making the transition away from fossil fuels and at least limiting the damage of climate change. But, of course, an awful lot of people on the Cape are more worried about what their view is going to be like for the next 20 years than what that entire natural system is going to be like for the next 20 million years.
In fact, we had Robert Kennedy on the program a few months back making his case that the view and the safety to fishermen was a bigger issue than what it was the wind power might provide for the people on the Cape. So what about it, Connection listeners? 1-800-423-8255. When you look at the changes that you're seeing in your own backyard, are you making the connection to climate change, looking at global warming? And let's go a little bit further in the next segment of the program. Let's talk about whether or not the politician should act or whether or not the politician should react. And if reacting is what they need to do, then maybe they need to hear something from people. But they're not hearing much from people right now. Why is that? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Bill McKibben's with us on the program. He has been writing about global warming and climate change. In fact, 15 years ago when he wrote a book, The End of Nature, he was asking questions about why it was that no matter what was destroyed or what became extinct, people all around the world would cling to the idea that nature, no matter what we did to it, would continue to persevere, and wondering whether or not, in fact, that's the way the world looks at the world today. 1-800-423-TALK. We also have with us Mark Linus. He is a contributing writer in the latest edition of Granta. His piece is called Hot News. He's also filled up a few passports traveling around the world looking at evidence of global warming. He's got a book coming out called High Tide News from a Warming World. Let's go to Holly Springs, North Carolina now. And Tom, you're with us on the program. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I do believe in the stewardship of America and of the world, but where's the scientific? I hear a lot of nice analogies of evidence that the it's getting warmer. But where was the scientific evidence where the glaciers were melting in the Grand Canyon and before the Industrial Revolution, which brought on all the toxic gases and the ozone destroying chemicals, which is why it's getting hotter? Is this just a natural cycle that is happening with the Earth that our scientists don't seem to have a greater grasp of? I do believe in stewardship. We should eliminate these gases, but There just seems like an awful lot of alarmist views being presented without...
All right. Mark Linus, the glaciers have been melting for hundreds of years. Why is it different when we look at what's happening now?
Well, I think your caller must be referring to the changes since the end of the last ice age, when there were huge glacial movements and massive glacial retreats across the North American continent and across the rest of the North and Southern Hemisphere as well. And these changes are very well explained. The reason they happened was because of minute changes in the Earth's orbit, and that's very much understood by science. And this is not a process which is currently underway. So the current retreat of the glaciers cannot be explained by anything other than global warming. And it's very clear that the glaciers are retreating. Every single mountain range in the world is now losing glaciers at a very rapid rate indeed, and probably more rapidly than any time since for the last 10,000 years at the very least. So it's clear that something very major is going on. It's clear that it's not a cycle. It's not something that we've experienced before in human history. And it's also clear that unless we do start tackling greenhouse gas emissions, this change is really quite likely to spiral out of control, and we will be facing a catastrophic situation which is without precedence in previous human experience. And that's such an important thing to understand, and I quite understand why people are very unwilling to face up to this, because it's something that we cannot, you know, we like to look back in, whether it's the legal systems or politics or anything, we like to look back over history to have some kind of guide for how to behave into the future. Well, there really isn't such a thing for this. We've never had a situation where the entire chemistry of the atmosphere has changed, and all the weather patterns and all of the climatic zones will be shifting all over the place. And that's not something which has happened before, and we're going to have to face up to the fact that unless we do something about it very quickly, we are going to be sitting looking at a catastrophe.
Tom, back to you in Holly Springs. What are you thinking?
So he's saying that if we do change our policies, that we will be able to stop the rise of the oceans, because the glaciers will stop because we change our policies. Yeah, it just seems like an alarmist policy. I do believe we should do controls on the waste gases, but he's saying that if we do these policies, that the oceans will not rise again because we've stopped our...
Jump in here, Bill.
Tom, I mean, we've waited too long for that. There's a certain amount of damage. The atmospheric concentration of CO2 is closing in on 400 parts per million. It's up about 40% since the end of the Industrial Revolution, higher than it's ever been in Earth history. We've done a lot of damage already. We've locked in major increases in temperature. The only question for this century is, how bad is it going to be? And if we summon all kinds of will and resolve to make the transition much more quickly than we're currently making it from fossil fuel to some other form of powering our lives, then we may be able to limit the situation to miserable instead of catastrophic. That's the choice that is going to be made. And it's going to be made more than any place else in the U.S. We contribute 25% of the world's CO2, and it's especially ironic that the effects are being felt first and most profoundly in places, because of the physics of global warming, in places like the Arctic and the Antarctic and Mongolia and the South Pacific, in Bangladesh, places that produce virtually nothing in the way of carbon dioxide and are not part of the problem.
Let's go next to Dave, who's joining us now on the line from Boston. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I don't know what I'd do without NPR and shows like this. First, I want to say that I find it very hard to talk about the issue of global warming without sort of hyperventilating, because the apocalyptic nature of the things being discussed is always, you know, something that's a strong background to any discussion.
Sorry, are you saying that you hear it being overstated, Dave, or you wish it was stated a little more loudly?
Oh no! For me, I'm absolutely convinced that global warming is very much a reality all around us, and that.
Why? What do you see? Tell me what you see.
Well, I've been a tree climber. Other than just reading the papers regularly and noticing with the rest of the scientific community, on the planet, except for a few fringe groups, that there is strong evidence for global warming. I myself have been a tree climber in the Boston area for 20 years, and I've seen real changes in the weather. I mean, and also in the capacity of just trees to deal with the changes.
Well, give me what you consider to be perhaps the strongest example of what you've seen.
Well, I think just the swings in cycles. Everybody who's in the industry knows that, you know, spring is usually a lot earlier, and the strange weather is just happening in the winter all of a sudden. So, I think you could go on talking about whether global warming is an issue or not, and talking about anecdotal or scientific evidence. But I'd just like to throw out something, which is that that to wait, to adopt an attitude of wait and see, is frankly immoral. That, given the solidity of the science currently, to look at that and see that we might be responsible for just an absolute catastrophe on the planet is immoral, and that the American people are in quite a bit of a state of denial about this. It's a denial that has been cultivated by people whose interest it is to cultivate that kind of denial, mostly corporations, certain corporations. People, business is good. We don't want to, you know, introduce new policies. So global warming is about politics. It's about the issue of rich and poor primarily, and it's also primarily about power, and that means U.S. power, because we seem to control the board, maybe not as much as we would like to, although the Bush administration currently is hard at work at that. But
Let me, if I can, go to Mark Linus on this. Mark's listening in from Britain, and Mark, you've heard both Bill and Dave speak quite forcefully about the role the U.S. could play here and chooses not to. Is that the way that it is seen in all the places that you visit?
Pretty much, yes. I have to say, it's always very easy to attack the Bush administration because they're so clearly in denial about this and so clearly responsible for preventing the rest of the world actually doing something about greenhouse gas emissions. And also, it's so clearly corrupt in the sense of how big corporate donations have bought so much influence at the administration level. And anyway, without going too deeply into this, it's something which is right there at the top of everyone's minds, from Tuvalu to China to Peru. I kept hearing over and over again that Bush is a criminal, Bush is destroying our culture. Bush, you know, in Tuvalu, it's a matter of national survival. Their country will cease to exist. Geographically, it will be wiped off the face of the map. And this is something which has never happened before in human history either. And they're thinking about perhaps doing a court case where they could sue the administration or sue ExxonMobil or sue whoever to have some kind of compensation for the fact that their nation is being wiped out. But I think they wouldn't have much chance of that in terms of actually succeeding in the courts, given the current state of the law. But it's quite clear that the Bush administration is very much blamed for this, and quite rightly so.
All right. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. 1-800-423-8255. Dave, thanks for that. Next to Burlington, Vermont. Jason, you're with us.
Hi.
Hi.
I have more of a comment, maybe a question. The counter-argument to global warming, or to people who believe in global warming, is often these alarmists. And I just don't understand why is it that if we are being alarmists for taking global warming seriously, why is it we cannot just take it seriously for the... Just because take the whole argument of global warming seriously.
But it's the easiest argument, isn't it, Jason? For no matter what you say, I say, oh, you're being alarmist. It's a sort of one-size-fits-all rebuttal. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, and it just seems like, why is it we can't all, I mean, I know this is a little Pollyanna, but can we all just sort of say for a moment, okay, let's just take it seriously for a year. Maybe this is something we should take that could really end up killing all of us. And I don't understand what is the danger of, why is it they think we're being alarmists for believing this? I mean, what do they think our agenda is?
Bill. Here's the danger. If we're going to take this seriously, it means ending our reliance on cheap fossil fuel. That's going to be difficult to do and expensive to do. By no means impossible to do. The Europeans now have ambitious national plans that would reduce their CO2 output by 50%. States are doing the same thing. Here at Middlebury College, we're doing our best to figure out a plan to cut by 20 or 30% the amount of CO2 that we use to heat and power the campus. These things are within the realm of the possible, but they're not easy or simple, and they're going to gore a lot of special interests. The question is it worth keeping the particular habits of the last 50 years in the U.S. alive for another 25 at the risk, and in fact no longer even at the risk, at this certainty of exacting planetary scale damage of a sort that no one even thought possible until about 15 years ago.
Bill, you talked earlier in the program about the moral imagination of trying to make sense of this. And I hear in your voice and see in your writing that you're not getting any satisfaction in a sort of I told you so way, because what you wrote about 15 years ago is still with us today.
You know, the question becomes, what's the proper emotion, I guess? And you could say anger. We should be angry at what we're doing to the world. We should probably feel guilty, and a lot guiltier than we do, because of our oversized role in causing it. For me, in a way, in the end, the real emotion is a kind of sadness, an almost elegiac sense of the incredible loss that comes from taking a planet where we're one of the creatures on it, living in some place whose rhythms are larger than our own, and subjecting every bit of it to our own particular degradation in this case.
But to the point that we get to choose our emotions, wouldn't anger be a more useful one in terms of mobilizing people?
It might be. Although I think that, and certainly, I mean, it's one that I've worked with and will continue to work with, and everyone else will too.
Yeah.
But, you know, at some level, we may also have to come to terms with a certain kind of deep grief about what it is that we're doing before we can begin to really deal rationally with our role in it. It just seems to me that this is a test that human beings, our institutions, and as individuals, we're failing so far. And we've got to figure out how to think about it in some much more wholehearted way than we've been able to date.
Mark Linus, just very briefly from you on how you judge, see, hear the emotions of the people in the places that you're visiting.
Well, I think sadness is one of the things that I certainly felt, and I could see other people feeling. It's difficult not to be in despair sometimes. I have to be honest with you about that. When you wake up and you see the floods, or you wake up and you see the glaciers that's gone, and you see that every single time you mention this, people come up with some reason for not believing it. Whether it's, if I write in the papers here, people write in saying, I don't think global warming's happening because of A, B, and C, which I've read on the internet, none of which is scientifically justifiable, but people are desperate to believe that they can go on driving their cars, they can go on consuming as much electricity. And so this state of sort of really societal denial is absolutely across the board at the moment. It's not just the politicians, it really is the general public. And it's like you have this sort of, Bill's written about this, where you have this kind of dream where you're screaming, everyone please, there's this huge catastrophe waiting to happen, and nobody's hearing you. And this silent scream is something I feel all the time. And I just hope that people can hear this, and people can get the message, and people can actually begin to face up to what's really going on in the world.
Mark, thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
Thanks.
Mark Linus, his Granta essay is called Hot News, and Bill McKibben, good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure.
Bill McKibben, his essay in Granta magazine is Worried? Us? The edition is called This Overheating World. Earlier in the program, we talked with Philip Marsden and the BBC reporter Tim Hirsch from Milan, Italy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.